Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about podcasts while walking, reporting on the successful Einstein-de-Haas experiment. So these are practical project podcasts, which I'm giving up practical project outcomes, and for the Podimations, it's going up to well over 30 iteration. I suppose iteration is the word for it, where things are improved. right into little details like getting a lapel microphone and actually mounting it on yourself so there's no rustling sound. So hopefully this is a good quality getting through. So there's a range. Obviously I've got rehab targets internally to get up to speed, and then there's external obstacles to get across, and to those external obstacles, so they're sort of half external, half internal. So when you're socializing and you want to talk about sophisticated stuff, if you don't have a model physically there, you sort of wipe out half your audience and half your support system. So obviously, to build up your ability to podcast and speak is one aspect of it, but another aspect is to actually get into physical actuality some of the complex ideas you have so someone can actually see it. Now, if it's in competition with existing ideas, like if it's an app or a form of mathematics, and they see it, they can see it works, but it's different. And so working through that, one of the things you wanted to do is actually get a physical demonstration of something that they can see very easily in a non-complex way, and sort of get it to your level. So there's a sort of like two levels, two problems. There's sort of stumbling along and falling against problems at my level, and then coming at that level having something that people can mezzanine in. It's sort of like two ramps up there. So along came the suite of practical projects, and they were the Einstein-de-Haas, the Thompson effect, and the scale projects. And it was interesting, just on the side issue, to see the scale of projects. That has a problem in that our sense of scale, or our system of mythology, is something which is very fiercely protected because it's structured in our society. So you get an initial burst of positive energy, but then the walls come down. And so this is the a bit like The Great Escape, where they've got several tunnels. When one tunnel fails, you've got another tunnel going forward. And so of these three sort of practical things, tunnels to come through, they provided incentive organization where you could scrounge for ideas, relations with people, and you could roll out a particular tunnel, a particular direction, actually stop and see if you're getting negative feedback for it. And now, specifically for any project, there's the negative feedback of if it's a bit beyond understanding, if it's not seen, it's not demonstrated, it's very hard for people to believe. It's great. People that consider their early adopters, when there's something which is proven, which is obvious, which is logical, and they can take it up. Well, yeah, they might be an early adopter, but they're not in the zone of that fuzzy front end of producing things. So there's the Thompson effect, which fortunately has come along, and then there's the Einstein-de-Haas effect, and we'll just describe what that is. So if I have a sample with electrons which orient to magnetic field. When I flip the magnetic field, the electrons will also flip, and in doing so they will change their sense of momentum, angular momentum, and impart a rocking motion to your pendulum. And this was proposed in 1908. One would be able to see this, and Einstein and de Haast worked on it from for many years and published a paper in 1915, the year that people associate Einstein with general relativity. He also wrote this paper doing the analysis of what was going on. And we'll get, I suppose, back to it. So I have a sample in a magnetic field, and if I flip it, I can get it to rotate. Now, if this is in a pendulum, in a torsion pendulum, will have the force, returning force, equal to the, I'm absolutely shocked by the actual strength of this effect that I'm seeing. It's like, it's enormously big. So it's something that people don't demonstrate. They don't, it's too hard, it's left off, but I can tell you now that it's easily done. The idea is that this pendulum, like any pendulum, the force, returning force, is proportional to the extension. So extension is proportional to acceleration. Differential equation there, x double dot, the second derivative, is proportional to displacement. Put that in, you get a harmonic oscillator solution. And so if you basically hang a piece of ferrite on a rubber band, that piece of ferrite will oscillate. And it's pretty shocking to see the amount which it picks up and oscillates. We'll have a natural frequency. So that's essentially what I did in terms of the traditional experiments have been using a piece of iron, but iron gets magnetized, and it's just one thing. B, it's very heavy, and C, it's not a material of choice. 100 years later, ferrite is a material of a choice, because ferrite has got is very light, and it's got a responsiveness to the magnetic field. It's used instead of an iron core because it's better than an iron core, because it doesn't have eddy currents in it. It's non-conduction. So ferrite is basically a ceramic of magnetic material. Ceramic in that it's a particle which is ascended and pressed together. And it has no permanent magnetization. So you can go up, it doesn't form domains, but it forms little nanodomains. And it responds at very high frequency, slightly higher frequency, greater loss characteristics. And we don't use it in the old transformers, but we use them in our modern switch mode transformers. And these ferrite rods that you can buy from JCAR are the leftovers from an era when you needed ferrite rods. I don't know why they've got ferrite rods at the moment. I'm just going to stop here and be back with you soon. So back broadcasting again. Thankfully cool evening in Sydney. I've got a little bit of a sore throat, so hopefully it's a better podcasting voice. But I've stopped off for a milk drink that I've bought at the service station late at night as I'm walking around here, just to smooth my throat a little bit. But getting back into it, the Einstein-de-Haast experiment, the key idea, the overall idea, is that there's a forest of complex obstacles to rehabilitation. One is the getting the ideas together, the skills together, the words together. But when you come across it, there's also thought areas that when you work through it, you come up with, oh, this is an area I should go ahead. And you need to actually focus down on things that people can physically see. And in this case, you have an apparatus with a ferrite pendant, and the ferrite pendant will start to oscillate. To the magnetic field, and the idea here is it's a suite of practical projects which you can apply skills to and get across the line. So all these practical projects I'm asking myself is that doable, and first off, you simply don't know, which is really a researcher's view. You don't go, oh, it can't be done, or can be done. You basically have a third answer. Well, let's research it. So essentially, I have a stand-in power supply, 1 amp power supply. I do have a 3 amp beauty power supply. Amps is a quantity of electricity that I have ready, but I have to tap a friend to ask him to bring it back from my old workplace. So I know the what I'm designing for. I want a magnetic field, and so there's a forest of fairly simple problems which are solved by universities. Professionals can solve it, and it's just a matter of finding a solution that actually does work. So the first thing is, this is fantastic stuff. So you flip the magnetic field in time to the resonance of the pendulum, and sorry, I'm just catching my breath. I should be a lot better. I really have to not even take a day off doing this type of stuff. It's a real real pressure to keep on going. Essentially you have a magnetic field and you want to reverse the current precisely to the resonance of the thing dicking back and forth. So you have to build a coil, get a current source, and get a pendulum, put it in there, and actually just assemble all these things for essentially your budget, which is say $30 Australian. So with $30 Australian, you have to actually build something, promote it, build it up, and get yourself going. So if you take an overview of the system, which is knocking out all these scientists all over the place, it's a sort of a Conan the Barbarian scenario. So I'll just go back to the Conan the Barbarian, because I've got a bit of a while to talk about him. So in the original Conan the Barbarian, they had sort of a Stone Age or Bronze Age society, and people would come raiding, and they'd take the little kids from the different villages and make them slaves. And to start off with, what they'd do is they'd get them on a big grinding stone with these poles coming out, and about five kindergarten kids per pole, and they'd pushing around and around. It would have been slashed, whash, pushed around. And what would happen is, a little while later, there'd be seven. But there'd be noticeably, still the same amount, but sort of a few. There'd be, we no doubt, 8 fewer. By 14, there was only 5 left, and then 16, 2 left, and then finally, there's Conan the Barbarian. And you can have two different views of saying it, that yes, making it so tough for Australian scientists to teach is great, because you winnow out any scientist who's got not a chance of helping you, but can only get these scientists which can bounce back and quietly calculate their way to the front line for $30, that type of stuff. It's great, but it's also mad. But let's celebrate the madness, because for $30, I've got this little core of a radio, a ferrite core, dancing back and forth to the time of the magnetic field, and basically it's picked up its natural beat. So I'll discuss a bit more about doing it, but essentially after a journey through building my own 555 timer and dual pole relay control. Oh, firstly, I built up as much as I could of the apparatus so that I could actually get the sort of the basics in place. A stand to hold it up, and initially a spring to hold the ferrite core, and I used plumber's tape and copper sprung, and that had a reasonably fast oscillation time. Now, one of the things you want is that you want a rapid oscillation time. The reason you want that is that you get a certain kick per oscillation. So if you have an oscillation time of 5 minutes, that's okay, but you only get one kick every 5 minutes. So you want it to have a low moment of inertia, which you can get by having a ferrite rod and you're spinning it on its symmetric axis. So that's good. And then you want a reasonably sharp spring to hold it up. You could get a wire, but unlike gravitational things where you have a wire and it's got to be very thin, very strong to carry the weight, it's got to carry no weight. And so eventually I went from copper wire held on with plumber's tape to a rubber band, which is held on by another rubber band to create a hook around it. Then through it a rubber band which is cut, because I only had rubber bands from our local, I don't know what, where they kept from, but I cut that. And then hooked it over and tied it together with a piece of a little copper wire, and up the top with a little piece of copper wire, and then a cross section. So the entire apparatus is built from little scraps of 80-20 lab construction rods. So this is basically junk or crap from a factory which I decommissioned, and so rather than throwing these stuff out, a little box of it. So I built this up, and I've got a central rod to hold it all up, a cross at the bottom to stabilize it, and then a tea coming out or a cantilever coming out, and on that rubber bands, a rubber band to hold it, and looped, hooked into that rubber band. So the rubber band's cut, put over, and then bound to each other with a tiny bit of copper wire. That gets you your torsion pendulum. So I built, that's the second version. The first version I built with copper wire, because I wanted to do it with copper wire so I could actually do various things, but it sort of allowed me to actually play with the material, because I could change the size and number of turns to precision tune the torsion of the copper wire. So I wanted to do that, but it turned out not to be very, very practical. This is a bit sensitive to be moved, because copper wire doesn't have a yield. It's great, but it doesn't have a great... It's not like spring steel where you can deform it or spring back again. It's got a very low deformation stress. But it's good to set it up. And then I started off with a roll of copper wire and that I had, and I put a current through it to see what sort of feel I could get from it. And I realized from doing that, I had two sets of problems come up. One is the maximum magnetic field I could generate really didn't matter about the size, the density, because it would go into the ferrite rod. The ferrite rod would actually essentially take in the magnetic field lines. So what would happen is that effectively, as far as you can see from the outside, I've got this broad area of magnetic field lines, and then the effect of the ferrite is to actually channel the field lines through. And obviously I want a magnetic field strength sufficiently strong. So it's your magnetic field strength, or your flux, basically your magnetic flux, which will get flux pinched into your ferrite rod sitting down. So that's fairly obvious. And I think I've known this from modeling magnetic fields for beam lines, and also for making optoelectronic components, where the main point in optoelectronic components is you want them next to each other, but you use the magnetic fields to make Faraday mirrors and circulators and things like that. So you want to shield them. So you generate very quickly a very good feel for what's going on, and basically supercomputers come in and, you know, give it time, and it's almost done before you finish, because you have a generally good idea about what's going on. So here comes sort of the first misconception. So I'll be invited to sit in the back of someone's lesson, and people will tell their students that the North Pole, a little magnet, will be attracted to another magnet, which is just because, like charge, they won't make the distinction very strong. And you'll say afterwards, oh, had you heard that it's the actual magnetic field density, a dipole in a field density, a charge in an electric charge field, yes, but a dipole is field density. Your dipole is sampling two parts of the field for torque, and then you basically got a tidal force pulling it in. And they'll say, no, I'm wrong. Yeah, look, go back, you're wrong. And they will point open up a page of a textbook and point to it there and get actually quite aggressive. Or they might even say, my university professor told me this, and eventually you'll get a chance. Not exactly for these people, but you'll talk out and they're not that strong on it. However, the important point here is that your field density will, you will create a dipole. And what will happen is that your dipole will tend to want to move in your field density. So there's two things that you could do for that. One is to expand it. The largest expansion, so the larger you make it, the more parasitic field you have, to within reason, the more stable you can make it. But you can also increase the surface area. One of the things is that when I built the first one, you could just switch it on for about 3 minutes, touch it, and it would be too hot to touch. Yeah, a bit too hot to touch. And so, trying to look there, what it was basically so many watts of energy is given out for so much length of wire. And if that length of wire is stacked against other lengths of wires, it's not going to go. So what you have to do is you have to reduce the number of wires and actually make it, if you've got deep wires inside, deep inside, the heat energy can't get out. So you have to have what I've done is I used a soda bottle and used some aluminium foil. Now the great thing about aluminium foil, when you're using it for a mandrel as a something to hold it, is the aluminium foil will bend ever so subtly and hold your copper wire in place as you're doing it. So once you've wound it up, you can go there. So people tend to spray resin in it and put it together. And what happened when I built one length of wire, and there's no way that I could get it to the right way. And so to increase the resistance, reduce the current, but increase the magnetic field, I just doubled the amount of wire. I went in and bought another, I think, half a millimeter gauge wire. So it's not going to break apart, and you've got a good thing. And the actual, it's not, I suppose, it's not high temperature. It's something called this sort of plastic called capon. I've forgotten what it is. There's a special epoxy on the outside, which is your insulator. So it took a long while to unwind one wire which I had made, and I was going to make it to a thicker statement, but I had to unwind it, and I watched a whole tennis match as I unwound it. And of course, what happens when you unwind it, it unsprings, and you basically have to have your little initial spindle that you have it on and wind it through hours and hours, and sometimes it looks impossible to get through. So you've done that, then you wind it back up again on your soda bottle. Now the idea of the soda bottle is that you've got your aluminium foil and then your wire, and you just have two, and you don't bother soldering it together to start off with. You have your two end wires to solder later together, and then for this you want it on and keeping it to relative thinness. So the thinness basically gives your current rating that you can pump through it. So the bottom line is that if you know you've got power supplies up, which can provide so much power, you've got to get the power dissipation. And you've got this concern about heat. Like if heat's coming out of here, this will be enough hot air to wave your thing around. Now, in general, where I sort of just put in the calculations, I thought, oh, right, well, I want to get something which is observable. So to make it observable, I will set up a microscope on it. So I'll be able to pick up if anything's happening to within a factor of 1,000. So normally you have a light beam in, light beam moves, but unfortunately nowadays people seeing a light beam move, they just will not be impressed and not work. So you have to see it directly. So the great advantage of this Einstein, the Hass one, is that it's a big, you switch it on and you immediately get, I'd say 20 degrees movement, easily 20 degrees movement back and forth. And this is only just on one app. So I haven't really forced you to do anything yet. And, I've got other things up the track. So you wind it on here and you wind it onto your bottle. Now, because the bottle is plastic and you're pressing it, you're winding it on with a fair amount of tension, and that spindle is not going to move because it's you've got it sort of almost welded into your aluminium former. It's not going to move. And so what you do is you get your bottle and at the key time unscrew the top of your bottle, and the bottle will deflate and release your solenoid, and then you don't hang around too long. You wrap that with special high temperature, high voltage electric tape, which I happen to have from industry. So I do have a few things, Netto tape for this plastic thing for putting things on. This is high voltage tape. You need these sorts of things. Alright, I'll describe a little bit later on the pain. I think my vision's come back. This is one of the great things as your brain rebuilds itself, the quality of your vision improves. I still need glasses and for precision solder. So you have this thing, and this is the design solenoid. Not a perfect thing, and you've got to lash it to your 40, 80, 20 rod, and generally from fencing and a whole heaps of army stuff is how you lash something to a tree or a branch or something like that. And there's sort of a way of doing it, and with from clean rooms using aluminium foil as your handy wire, because they let in aluminium foil. Anything else, you have to go through the ISO 900 process to get it all ticked through. Someone comes up with a fluffy purse or a kitten, you know, in the clean room, so you learn how to do it. So a combination of this is forming aluminium ties, which you wrap over and do it. So in terms of army, it would be a drip flare. So you're walking along, and you, people you don't want are walking where you don't want, and they hit a drip flare, and it's all over Red Rover for them. From the idea. And so you've got to learn to lash things to trees. So basically using this to lash your field thing in there. And at this stage I wired it up and just checked it, and attached it to a little 1 amp 12 volt mother as a supply. These are the older supplies with the, you know, the old transformers. It's sort of not switch mode or anything like that. So it looks like it's insane. So for a fraction of the size, you can get 1 amp switch mode. Just a dream. But these are the big old things. And it's a bit of a head scratcher as to you know, where, what's, you know, why are these things there. I've got there, and sure enough, you can put this thing, pull it through it. So if you put your screwdriver in there, you can you can sort of gently feel the field, but if you put the piece of ferrite in there, two things, the ferrite turns into a powerful magnet, and you can, it's hard actually lifting your screwdriver off it. So you put your screwdriver on, and it's, you know, it's not impossible. You don't have to be Hercules or anything, but it's a little bit of, it's got this intention there. And also, you can feel your field gradient. So if, as you hold it to one side, it interacts and builds up and will move it from side to side. So if you hold it in the center, it's a saddle point in the center. It will move out off to the radius. So if you've just got this rod in the center, one way that the obviously people do it is make it a big heavy rod, so it just doesn't want to move out there. But I had to find out another solution to it, which I knew from building other stuff. So, and this is great for me because, like, there's a big reset hard drive wipeout, and so I've just get this information back. So we've got this solenoid and we've got our ferrite, and to simplify it, it's been held up with a rubber band yoke hooked onto another cut rubber band onto another rubber band, so that rubber band is cut and bent over and bound together with a bit of tiny, about a centimetre of copper wire on each section. So that's hanging out there. And underneath it, I place and make the pin, or a needle. And the thing about this needle, which is basically out of, I don't know if you buy jeweler's screwdriver kit, you get these funny looking things. You get your Phillips head, your slot screwdrivers, different sizes. You'll get a block, which what the heck would you use that for? And you also get a tiny point. And I would assume the tiny point is from the age when jewelers had to push in jewels, right? Jewels into watch faces to get their pendular rock, your pendular watch movement happening. But I've lashed this underneath, held up, and again with some plumber's tape, again as a general lashing to get there. Now of course people will want greater effect, but I'm obviously looking at dollars to take off time and holding things together so I can see what's not going to work, which is one of the major things that I'm up against. So this wire, this underneath it, has got this jewel screwdriver. It's a little point out the side, and the thing about the point is that it produces a beautiful flower of field lines underneath it. So the so it means that your little pendulum is not going to wander off anywhere. It will be sitting above these field lines. And then I've got to get a relay, which a twin pole relay, which when it flicks switches the actual direction of current, and put it up there. So I've got to get, so what I started off with was, this is going to be tough. Firstly, I built it up as much as I can and said, really, I've got very little left in my shed. I've got these, a soldering iron, which has given up the ghost. It you switch it on and there's some sort of thermal gap between it and the head, so it never heats up. The other one heats up to an enormous temperature, and essentially you have to switch it off and switch it on. If you've only got really a 20 second window before you can use it, before it becomes insanely hot. So I had those things there, so I went around to a mate's place and said, how about it? And at this stage, you know that you have the apparatus there, and so they have something to talk about. Because if you hit someone and they suddenly don't start understanding things, it's often hard to do. And they gave me a circuit that their friend made at work to indicate light level. And I'll go on to that pretty soon. So, yeah, they had a circuit. You opened up and there was a circuit there from JCar. So, essentially, look, gone are the days. Like, when I was at university, you could print out your circuit board, get your components, design the graph, float it in, produce it. So you can't do that anymore. So essentially, going back from here, this was a 2001 ilk 1990s circuit. And so I thought, oh, well, this one isn't powerful enough. I will have to build my own one from JCar. So JCar is our hobby store. It's a JCar UK, so I don't know what's happening here. So it's maybe an international thing. So I bought the international hobby one, and of the next version up, which had the 555 timer. So 555 timer itself is not a timing chip. It's just a thing with an open and close thing between two parts of a discharge curve. So you can actually discharge it and we'll send out a digital pulse for the time like this, and so that timer then can go to a counter, all right, to go across, like, which is the standard sort of things like this. This is the first sort of weird thing. So 2001, surely you had something more. Oh, we've had a revision, three revisions. Scratch your head, three revisions? What is this about? Oh, we found it made it more energy efficient. What the heck? Surely, when you look at a circuit, and so what obviously they had is something with a two lower resistor, just, you know, you've got a voltage divider in there with two lower resistance, and all your energy is going out for when you just want a voltage. Sort of bizarre like that. So it's, you know, it went harder and harder and harder, and going through it, your good skills getting out the old single resistors, but it was really poorly documented, really poorly written out. There were bits of the circuit which is not explained why it's there. There was odd pins sitting around up, and you had various points in time where you had to actually put a something called a link. And what they did is they gave you these zero resistance resistors to put into your circuit. So that's a bit of a, you know, and none of this is explained up front. And then the capacitors were, you had to really dive in to read the microscopic, when I say microscopic writing, you needed actually a microscope to read some of these stacked film capacitors. Great thing, stacked film capacitors. And then just curiosity after curiosity came up, and wired it up. It took me about a day of what. So essentially, the main thing is you don't have a clean workspace. So without you're outside with the birds and the breeze blowing through and dust going through and different lights. So the main thing is you can only do one step at a time. So I put in all the solid state, all the diodes, checked them, double checked them. Putting in all the capacitors, double checked them. Putting in there, all the resistors, double checked. I did make a mistake on that, but found it wired and it did work. But, you couldn't control it. But the other thing was that only could you control the time. The timing was erratic. The half second timing, which is what you needed to get to, that was erratic. It would flick your relay, but you could tell that that was not at all precise. So it's back to the drawing board. You know, what could I do to increase the accuracy? Firstly, the 555 wasn't used as a 555 timer should be, which is producing a digital pulse clock thing going. Now people now use quartz crystals, you know, in your, it's all, and in your scratching your head, and I sort of remember my father who built the first, you know, quite literally built the first computer, you know, Australia's fourth computer, so the world's fourth computer, and he and the engineers would be up there at night putting in individual triodes and various things like that, and folding and plaiting the wires and stuff like that. And he was describing to me about integrated circuits. They're bringing out integrated circuits. They put multiple things up, whole circuit boards, in a chip, and you know, wiring at that. And so, essentially, you got the message that why I'm basically reading a piece of papyrus and graphics and things don't make sense. Well, it's like I could easily tell you that some of the to link A and C, that gets you to link A and B. B's got to B prime, and so they've got these two link capacitors and the resistors don't sit properly on the board. You have to pop them up vertically, like it's got amateurism written into it. The reason is that the world has changed. So I sort of scratched my head, and then I had to dive into Arduino, which is $11, which was cheaper than the the kit. And you pick it up, and the components now, firstly, the circuit board's not that single-layer PCB, so where, you know, you couldn't get anyone to manufacture the first single-layer. This is multi-layer PCB, so, you know, wires, with some wires, mass-produced, and the components set by robot, point and welding way beneath anything you could do with a microscope. You wouldn't do it. You have to buy them. And there, the Arduino is a single chip, and it's everything you want. It's basically a PCI, a program control interface with digital IOs, analogs. You've got basically everything you want on a chip, and you have to, I suppose the frustrating thing for me is, I suppose you could read it, is USB control. For me, it's really interesting in terms of lab view control, how you'd get into it, but, so there it's there, and certain things like you can, on slightly greater models, you can just put an Ethernet connection to it and address it. So this has all got heaps of great things, the USB into it, and a big plunge. So eventually, I started off with the kit, and quite honestly, that probably took 2 days of getting getting your wiring back up to skill, and you were the side up and your hands out vibrating. which is one of the things. And so you sold her up and say, no way. And so I've got Arduino. And so how do you program it? Well, there is a web interface. You log in, you give your life details away, and you can use the lab interface for it. And so it's essentially you plug in your Arduino board, it will search it, put it up there, and you write a program, you press the button load, and it will load it to that board, which is sort of pretty okay. And they had a board for flash LED on and off, so that was, I use basically flash LED on and off, use their code and with the timing code, and then I hook that up to Arduino relay board, which I had, and have a solid state relay board, which I sort of really would have preferred. And then I had sort of the thing of what I want it to do is I want it to basically have the relay is a 2-pole relay, so that's great. So I want it to switch from 12 volts to ground. So one will be at 12 volts, and the output, one on the second relay, at 12 volts. Sorry, the ground, so it's 12 volts to ground, or ground to 12 volts, the current goes opposite ways. And I had thought for a short while, what I want to do is drive the relays off, one to go high and one to go low. And I must admit, I put it in the code, it didn't work. And so what I did was I reversed the polarity of the second relay. So they both go up, and it's to one wire goes to positive and one wire goes to ground. Both go down and reverses it. So I had it there. And got that up and running, and took it in baby steps, and sort of saying, oh, should I stop? And so this is all on the 1.125 inch, which is what, 22 inch things, the units there. Should I wait for it? No, I thought, well, I'll test it up and solder on to these wires and just get it up and going. And so I hooked it up and adjusted it a bit, the kit a bit. We're nearly there to working. And then the period, I had to get the period right. So what I did is I got the little pendulum and filmed it back. And then it was nearly there, took it to Camtasia, which gave me frame by frame picture. And then I had a rude discovery that the thing is goes in not full decimal. So the time, say 5.15 seconds, actually is 0.15 is actually half a second. It's 30 frames. So essentially, you'd advance one frame. Is so it's per second a frame. That's the way you get things. You don't notice it until you're actually there. So I rocked it, and it was 13 frames per rock, and 13 frames, 13 over 30 is 0.433. So that's 433 milliseconds. Put that in, and the Arduino is clocking away at that rate. And, you know, I went to check when I would see this pulsar. So according to my calculations, it should be, and it was a couple of minutes at least to see it. I might have to get my microscopes up to see it. And it was actually doing, you know, rocking around a full 10 degrees. I could almost see the pickup of it. Such a strong pulse, so it's a strong kick. So essentially I've basically picked the right things all the way through. Now, I think one of the great things is, in this case, like I'm sort of suffering error proneness. I just don't think I did some leaf sucking and left the bag open. So I'm making these, or I patched a pool toy and misread the pattern, put the pool patch in the wrong spot. So I'm aware of making these mistakes all the time, but when it sort of came to the crunch, so that making mistakes makes you, is it possibly a positive thing? It makes you pick things up going across. So I'm just going to take a break here. So I'm just stopping from time to time as I see these sort of unusual things in the bushes. Walking around, I'm about to head off home. So we're nearly there, so just taking a film of it, let me set it up, and it worked more or less right away. So we're up to this stage, and so I can sort of take my foot off the pedal, and there's going to be a few things to do. That is get some new automotive spade plugs to put in on the unit. Basically improve the unit, get ready for the 3-volt supply, get a really small picture of Einstein's face and wrap around it so you can film that. I'm just trying to think that's, it's basically wrapped up before it's done, which is sort of a lot of things that used to happen to me at university that send me into a prac thing and get it done very quickly, or solve it very quickly. So, essentially the same thing is here, but that's basically, I must admit, I suppose I had lost confidence. I thought, this is an area no one's looked at, no one's interested. So I tried to phone up my friends at Sydney University and say, look, there are these things I really want to get. I need a little bit of assistance to help. And then it's, oh, we are so busy, we're dealing with our first year students, blah, blah, blah. And basically, yes, but the barrier to deal with this is so high. And of course, that wasn't a desperate thing. That was basically shining you're out in the paddock and you shine your light, your flashlight in certain areas to see if there's any lies looking back at you to work out what to do. So I was basically shining my searchlight in that direction to work out what things are going. And so Arduino, I basically had the website, some knowledge of it, some knowledge that I'm on a dead end. It's sort of like you're going to the suburb and there's no services there and it's really run down and everyone's old, and you might go and get for a cup of tea, sit there, you get really old service, and it's sort of nice if you're in the mood, but you realise something is that the actions help it happening elsewhere. And really the action, it has to happen elsewhere, because the component size has shrunk and the component power has increased, so such that one chip can do basically everything. And so the big head scratcher for me is how much There's two components. There's the Arduino driver, but whether you should get Raspberry Pi to drive it, whether you should even stick with it. Is the Arduino dead in the water? Is everything going to be Raspberry Pi? Anyway, it's sort of like it's a big crushing blow. It's sort of, and you're really aware that no one's automating anything, like feeding them, and nor should that. I think basically you may as well sign yourself out of life if you need a unit to open and close curtains. I can well imagine the curtains are way up and you can't reach them, or I don't know what you need to do. I just think we're at an age of technology where it's not quite there yet, and I don't know, like the pump. The technology is just quite not there yet. It's not quite smart enough. You want it to detect a dirty floor, detect the scale of dirty floor, and monitor it. The feedback loop is not there fully. You want it to actually have sensors around the house to work out. It's not there in terms of that. You can't actually tell a person that you have saved so much money by doing this and going ahead. So I really can't work out exactly. There is obviously an educational need for this, and I just find the Arduino really sort of like, it's really positive, but it's actually a throwback to C++ programming. So it's a bit archaic and arcane. I think it's a real criminal that people are at school and don't actually get to use this in the everyday way of monitoring their environment. So it's so that there's that issue there. So what's happened is the Einstein to Hass has clicked over, and I just have to sit back and actually do the next things. One is put a little picture of Einstein on it. Two is replace the sort of tack soldering things with plugs. Three, I call it a show and get told. That is, if you're from the outside the university, it's not a show and tell. You are very much very contemptuously looked at, and you get told, well, I don't believe this is very interesting. This is it. But I've got to move up to that and move off to a what else? The Thompson effect thing. So it's all over. And I don't know if you've had the previous ones where I've actually talked about designing these little bits and pieces, and it's shockingly all over. Similar like the Potomation stuff. I thought that was a year, 2 years going, and really the bulk of it has been broken within 2 months. I've got to get back the quiz stuff. Again, the quiz stuff was going to be exceptionally hard to do. I was going to try and do voice recognition on my podcast, which I possibly could do now, but back then when I had poor quality podcasts, I couldn't do it. But essentially produce a quiz out of a podcast, or a series of 4 different styles lessons out of it. So I just have to keep on pushing and trying to understand it. What I really probably want to do is have someone come in on site and actually help me communicate it or interface.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.